This is a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation.
Okay, thank you for joining us at the teleconference for Dog Guide Handlers Australia tonight, which is the 25th of September 2019. I have a great honour of welcoming a special guest of Dr. Zoran Milicevic, who's a veterinary specialist at the Green Cross Vet in Narre Warren at Fountain Gate. Good evening, Zoran.
Good evening, John, and thank you very much for inviting me. This is the first teleconference, and I'm honoured to be able to share some information to fellow listeners and answer any questions or concerns that some of the fellow listeners may have.
Yes. What I'd like to do, first of all, everyone, is to see if we can do a roll call. And what I'll do is go through perhaps the various states and just see who we've got, who's we'd like to welcome along with us this evening. So first of all, if I could ask if there's anyone joining us from Western Australia.
Karen Passmore.
Karen.
Karen.
Hi, Karen.
Oh, that's wonderful. Welcome to you, Karen. Tell me, are you in Perth or in an outer area of Western Australia?
Yes, I'm in Perth.
Okay, and
Erica Webb from Perth.
Sorry, we'll just have one person at a time at the moment, if that's okay. And tell us your dog guide's name and what sort of a dog you have, Karen.
Beg your pardon?
What sort of dog do you have, and what's your dog guide's name?
Okay, I've got a seeing eye dog, age 7, and her name is Vega.
Vega. Oh, that's wonderful. Well, welcome to you, Karen. Is there anybody else from Western Australia?
Erica Webb from Perth.
I'm sorry, what was that name again?
Erica Webb.
Erica. Oh, thank you, Erica. Welcome to you as well. And can I ask you your dog's name and what kind of dog do you have?
I don't have a dog guide, but I am a former committee member of Dog Guide Handlers Australia.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you for joining us. And you're from Perth itself, are you, or an outlying area?
Perth.
That's wonderful. And anybody else from Western Australia that we have on the line?
Excuse me, John. Can I may just interrupt? Are you on speakerphone because you're echoing a lot?
Oh, am I? Okay.
And so was Zoran when he spoke.
Sorry, is that any better? I'm sorry. Just, I've got to try and make things as...
All right, if it can't be helped, it can't be helped.
Is that no better?
No, it's better.
No.
No, it's not.
No, not really.
Not really.
No.
Just have to concentrate.
It is.
Somebody's got their phone on speaker.
John, there are 18 or more people in the conference. I'm just wondering, should we maybe just get stuck into the vet talk rather than introduce everybody?
All right. Well, I just want to get an idea of who's joining us. Look, just give me one moment if we can. Just give me one moment. I'll try one other thing.
Is that any clearer for people?
Yes.
That's better.
That's much better.
So, John, can I suggest maybe just a quick run around of names and
worry
about dogs?
Okay. We've got people in Western Australia. That was Karen and Erica. Anybody else in Western Australia? No. What about in South Australia? No. In New South Wales?
Yes. Wendy and Tom are Wren.
What was your first name?
Wendy.
Wendy and Tom, is it?
Yes.
Okay. Welcome to both you and Wendy and Tom. And what area are you in?
I'm from New South Wales, and I have a guide dog called Amos.
Oh, that's wonderful. What part of New South Wales?
At the base of the Snowy Mountains.
In the Snowy Mountains, around Tooma or some lovely park like that. That's one. That's wonderful. Okay, anybody else from New South Wales?
Yes, Jackie Armstrong. I'm from Sydney and I have a guide dog, Nancy.
Welcome, Matt, Jackie, and it's lovely to have you with us there this evening. Anybody else from New South Wales?
Yes, I'm Kathy Egan and I'm from Sydney and I have a guide dog, Leon.
Welcome, Matt, Kathy, and thank you for joining us this evening. Anybody else from New South Wales?
Yes, it's along for Trust, and I'm from Aubrey, and I have a seeing eye dog, Zoe.
Welcome to you, Elsa Alonka. Lovely to have you with us there this evening. And was there one other person I heard there I think may have flashed in?
Don Scott from Western Sydney. My dog is Watson.
Welcome, Matt and Scott, and thank you very much for joining us there this evening. I hope you find it a very useful time. Anybody else that I've missed from New South Wales?
It's Katie Butler from Newcastle. It's Sadie.
Oh, that's great, Katie. Well, thank you for taking the time to join with us there this evening. I just want to be sure I haven't missed anyone, so just let me know if there's anybody else from New South Wales, please. No, well, that's great. Great turn-up from New South Wales tonight. Anybody from Queensland, please?
Yes. Joyce from Toowoomba.
Hello, Joyce.
Joyce from Toowoomba.
Yep.
And with guide dog Todd.
Well, thank you, Joyce, for taking the time to be with us there this evening. Very grateful. And somebody else from Queensland?
Yeah, you got Rose from Bundaberg with Sadie.
Well, thank you, Rose, for being with us there this evening, and I hope you find this will be a helpful evening. And other people from Queensland?
Yes. Esther Walker, Ipswich, Queensland.
Sorry, Esther, was it?
Esther Walker, Ipswich, Queensland, and my dog is seeing our dog, Jackson. I call him Jack.
Jack, do you? That's lovely. Okay, well, thank you for taking the time to be with us there this evening as well. Anybody else from Queensland?
Yeah, Nicole, Sunshine Coast, Guide Dog Olsen.
Well, thank you so much to Nicole for taking the time to be with us, and I hope you find it an informative evening. Anyone else from Queensland?
Yep, Bevan Warwick with our two dogs, and we better speed it up. So I think we're the last. Yeah, it doesn't matter. We won't mention it. Thanks.
Okay. All right, then. Anyone else from Queensland?
Yeah, Rowena Dowling from Sunshine Coast.
And your dog's name, Rowena?
Dogless and desperate at the moment. I'm on the waiting list.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, hopefully that comes through shortly for you. Anyone else? No? Okay. We'll turn to Victoria. Anybody from Victoria?
Francois Jacob from Melbourne with my guide dog Nordic.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight, Francois. And anyone else?
Yeah, Jamie Kelly with Gambler.
Thank you for being along with us also, Jamie. And anyone else?
Yep, Nina with guide dog Nixon.
That's Nina, is it?
Nina.
Nina, yes. Thank you, Nina, for that. Anybody else in Victoria?
It's Deborah with my guide dog, Roy.
Thank you, Deborah. That's wonderful to hear from you tonight as well. I'm moving along, but I do want to cover everybody because everybody is important. So anyone else in Melbourne or Victoria? No? Okay. What about Tasmania or any of the other states that we have, Northern Territory or any of the states that I've not been through?
It's Anne Jackson from Hobart with guide dog Billy.
All right. Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us tonight, Anne. Anybody else? We haven't said hello to? No. All right. Well, look, thank you so much. Now I'd like to, without any further ado, to introduce to you, Zoran, we've sort of rearranged the technology, so I hope it's more audibly pleasant for you. So we're actually holding up separate handsets. Now you're hearing me, all right? And what I'd like to do is to introduce Zoran, who will first of all just tell you a bit about himself, what his experience is, how he first became aware of assistance animals and so forth. So good evening to you, Zoran.
Hi, good evening, and thank you very much, John, again. And obviously, good evening to everyone across Australia, and thanks for having me to have a little bit of a chat to you guys. To give a little bit of background to where I've come from, you guys will probably pick up a strange accent and with a strange name. So I was born, raised, and educated in South Africa. And after graduating with my veterinary degree, I worked in the UK for a period of time, pretty much mostly in small animal practice. Went back to South Africa, worked in private practice there for a few years, and then eventually my wife and I decided to emigrate to Australia in 2001, and initially started off in the central coast of New South Wales, and then moved down to Melbourne, where I joined a practice called Glen Huntly Road Veterinary Clinic, which is a practice that used to do some veterinary work for the seeing eye dog. And that was my introduction to the guide dogs, and obviously their importance in the community life of visually impaired people. So that was quite an experience to be part of, and something that I certainly thoroughly enjoyed, and I've always enjoyed working with clientele and their respective guide dogs, which are amazing creatures. I then set up a practice in the southeastern corridor of Melbourne called Fountain Gate Veterinary Clinic, which was opened up in Pets at Home store, which was the first combined pet shop with a veterinary clinic and grooming salon, and ran that for 15 years. And eventually I was acquired by Green Cross and have now become the veterinary director of Green Cross Narre Warren Clinic. So that's pretty much where I've come from, and it's certainly been a great career to be part of, and something that it's a great experience, and especially when you have the likes of guide dogs and seeing eye dogs that you have an association with, it makes you realise how incredible those dogs are, and how important they are to obviously the lives that they help every single day. So yeah, it's certainly a wonderful association to be with, and I've known John for I think at least 15 odd years. I think I was only open for a few months when he presented at the clinic with a beautiful dog called Baron, who was his assistant's dog at the time, and it was a great working experience and relationship that we shared over the years. And obviously he's had a few other dogs, and now he has a beautiful dog called Heidi, and again, just an amazing dog to see how beautifully they do work, and how committed they are to their respective owners and handlers. So it's an amazing thing to see.
Thank you very much indeed, Zoran. If I might just ask, I mean, when you initially began, I suppose, your life in the veterinary profession, was it something that was clear to you that was the sort of profession you wanted to go into, or the pathway that you wanted to take in life?
Yeah, look, it's I've always had an association with pets. We obviously grew up having a menagerie of pets at home, and certainly being in South Africa, where you get exposed to certain elements of wildlife, and there was always certainly a strong call to head in that route, and I was just fortunate enough to be accepted into the veterinary fraternity, and have certainly thoroughly enjoyed. And as part of my course in my final year as a student, I was very fortunate to be able to work with the head veterinarian of the Kruger National Park. So they're getting to treat and manage and work with wildlife such as elephant, giraffe, lion. It was just an amazing experience. So something that I'll certainly treasure and always hold very dear. But working in practice in Australia, you obviously get to deal with certain elements of wildlife that do get brought in, and again, it just makes you realise the beauty of all animals that we share this beautiful world with. And it certainly makes it a terrific career to be able to do all those things.
Thank you for that, Zoran. And I'm well aware that you show a lot of concern and display a great deal of compassion to wildlife and give of your time. And I think that's one thing that makes my admiration of you even higher. But I suppose not to waste any time on my thoughts, I want to now see if you've got any sort of tips or tricks or anything that you can share with people on a general basis at this point in the year where there might be a particular problem that's prevalent within assistance animals or pets that that perhaps people that don't have vision or that have an assistance animal of any kind can look out for and what action might need to be taken.
Okay. All right, John, yeah, absolutely. Look, I know one of the topics that was mentioned was obviously forms of first aid that can be applied, and you know, those are things that's always key, could be at any time of the year where you have some awareness of how to handle a situation that gets presented to you. Obviously, whatever first aid can be applied at the time before an animal gets taken to the respective vets and so forth. Probably one of my key messages for all the listeners is to, one, always make sure that you have the phone number to your local vet or whichever vet that you do choose to use, always available and easily accessible, so that if there is an obvious concern that you do have, that it's a quick call. And it might be just a case of having a quick discussion with the vet or the nurse that's there, and obviously their best details of how to get through to them, because always in situations having an opinion of the local vet and so forth to help you through a situation is very important, or taking the animal down for care. So having their details is always essential to have on hand. Likewise for after hours, where your vet is not going to be accessible, having the local emergency center contact details, again, available, so that if you're in a situation and you do need to call somebody with critical time, then obviously having that number easily accessible, I think, is such a key and an important thing to have there. Have a good relationship with your local vet as well. I think that's an important thing, so that you can obviously discuss any concerns that you might have, because, look, realistically, the animals that you do have, they are, you know, incredibly valuable commodities or parts of your lives, and you really want to make sure that you keep them in the best health and well-being possible, because you're really totally dependent on one another to varying degrees, I suspect. And so to make sure that your dog is kept in a good, healthy condition, I think it's always an absolutely essential thing. And regular vets, and I think having that close relationship is certainly a good thing to have on hand. Now, with regards to when you are obviously presented in a situation of first aid, a lot of the time it's going to be a critical thing that you won't really want to be on top of as quickly as possible. A key thing is to make sure that you stay calm. When there's a stressful situation that's happened or something that has happened to your pet, there might be forms of distress and discomfort and so forth. And if you have a owner that is panicking and getting stressed, that adds to the pet's distress and uneasiness. So be calm, be relaxed, talk in a gentle tone. Don't rush to the pet, because very often a pet that is being rushed to can again feel stressed and concerned in that situation. So always handle manners as gentle and relaxed as you can. I know it's easier said than done when obviously you present it in a situation, but it definitely helps the animal calm a bit better if one is handling it in a better frame of mind. And certainly your thought process is a lot more relaxed as well when you're a little bit more at ease in a situation.
Yes. I suppose the pet or the animal, I mean the assistance animal, takes a lot from your state of mind too, wouldn't he, Zoran?
Most definitely. Absolutely. That, you know, they are reliant, and because they've got that such a close association with their handlers, they do respond very much so to that response that you're showing them, definitely.
Thank you.
Again, in emergency situations, always be mindful of your situation and your present condition. Obviously, you don't want to put yourself into any situation that may harm yourself. So such as, you know, if there had been a road accident or so forth, again, always be mindful of your situation first. And if you're safe, then obviously you can tend to your pet. It's, that's a, that would certainly be a very key thing. Make sure that you are mindful that if a pet is in obvious pain and distress, be careful with your pet because they can respond and bite inappropriately or inadvertently. You know, that's not something that they mean to do, but when they put into such a stressful situation, that they sometimes can react that way. So always be mindful that you want to be very careful around handling that, again, that you're not being bitten in the process there. Sometimes having a towel where you can wrap around the patient at the time provides a bit of support, provides a bit of comfort, but also provides a bit of protection from those sorts of incidences happening. So that certainly does help significantly there. Don't forget to, if you've dealt with the situation, call the vet when you're en route to let them know what's happened, how long ago had this happened, what has happened, and what treatment you've done at the time, so that they can prepare themselves for whatever situation would be arising at their clinic on, so that, certainly having some form of preparedness is always such an essential thing. And depending on the type of emergency that's taken place, they might say, look, don't come to us, rather head straight to an emergency centre, because in certain circumstances, heading straight to the emergency centre might be a more sensible time management thing. For example, let's say if a dog's been bitten by a snake, a lot of clinics won't stock antivenins because of the infrequency of use or the cost of the medication, whereas we know all specialist centres and emergency centres would have that on hand. So those sorts of things. Yes.
Can I just stop you? It's Nicole. When you say emergency centre, are you meaning an emergency veterinary centre or an emergency human centre?
Emergency veterinary centre. So most centres would have various emergency pet centres around, and you'll find that majority of those would be operational mostly after hours when they know that most veterinary clinics would be closed. So, yes, there are pet-specific emergency centres, and I know certainly Melbourne has at least three or four within reasonable proximity. So I'm sure most other centres would have relevant emergency centres as well.
Well, thank you very much for that, Zoran. That's excellent. And it's something to keep in mind because we do need to sort of prioritise the seriousness of the situation that we face as to whether it's going to be something that we need to address directly to the vet or whether we need to sort of focus on a hospital or animal emergency service. Now I suppose we should open the floor and if that's convenient with yourself, Zoran, and see what the members and participants would like to ask. So the best way for us to do that is to ask you if you could mention your name, and then we'll take one person at a time so that it can be clearly heard by everybody that's on the that's at the teleconference, if that's all right.
Karen?
Yes, Karen.
Okay.
Welcome.
Zoran, I'm Karen and I live in Perth. A friend of mine's dog guide became very sick and she called a taxi and she wanted to go to the emergency hospital and the taxi driver refused to take the dog. What do you do in a situation like that?
Look, Karen, that's certainly very unfortunate that sort of situation arises. I would like to believe that most of the taxi organisations would have a priority understanding that when there is assistance dog that's needed to travel with the handler, that would be knowledge. Now, I'm not sure whether there's a particular request that you have to put in to say that you are travelling with a guide dog. I'm not sure what the association. I presume, obviously, maybe some handlers or some taxi drivers feel that they don't have the vehicle that accommodates for that. So whether it's just something that when you put in the request for a taxi, that you stipulate you are travelling with a guide dog. And I'd certainly hope and like to believe that there would be a lot of organisations that would be more than happy to take both a handler and the guide dog. John, I'm not sure if you have any input in whether that's something that's an issue with certain taxi companies?
Yes. Well, in fact, state by state, legislation does alter. But, for example, in Victoria, there is it is not lawful for a taxi driver to refuse a person who has a registered and accredited assistance animal. So in that case, not that it would be of much help once the driver decides to be stubborn or unhelpful, I mean, it's because drivers still do that here, even though it's against the law, but you do have also the option of, I suppose, in the very last resort, you could try calling a animal ambulance, a pet ambulance, but the law in most states, whether it's a toothless tiger or not, which is a different subject for another night for a different teleconference, but the most places do have the disability discrimination legislation, which says that it would be an offence to refuse an assistance animal based on the fact that it is a registered and trained animal. And states might vary slightly with the legislation, but that's generally the effect of it.
Soren, again, it's Nicole. Just a quick question about, I mean, obviously on a hot day we carry, well, I'm guessing most people carry water and a collapsible water bowl for our dogs and that sort of thing. Are there other simple first aid, like, I mean, obviously when you're sight impaired, you don't have a car, so quite often we're just using a backpack. So are there other simple things we could carry, like almost like a mini first aid kit for the dog without it being too heavy? Like, is there some sort of as natural stingos, or should we carry little bandages or something? Like,
I think having a little basic first aid kit, I think, is probably important for everyone to really have on hand, because you never know when a situation is going to happen. And, look, certainly because you've got your guide dog with you. So the basic things such as absorbent gauze pads, I think, are a great thing to have. You know, if there's a basic cut, a laceration, I suppose, walking through the streets, there's always a risk, you know, of glass cuts, et cetera. So, you know, there's going to be potential bleeding at times. So that can work very nicely, not only for providing support, but also to sort of provide protection as well there. So that's good to have certain bandaging materials where you can obviously wrap the gauze swabs and so forth. So, again, a few basic types of wraps that would be easily available. And most first aid kits would have a variety of wraps that one can apply at blunt-ended scissors. So that when you're having to cut the bandage material, being blunt-ended, obviously you're not going to traumatise yourself or the pet by being by utilising that. Tweezers, I think, can be of some use. So, for example, if we've had a thorn or a twig or something that's gone into a foot, again, I suppose depends on the degree of vision impairment that one has, but having tweezers to remove such things can certainly be of some assistance. Sterile saline can be of some benefit if let's say we've had some dust and dirt get into the patient's eye, that we can apply a little bit of saline to the eyes to help flush that out, I think can certainly be of value. Likewise, when we've got wounds and so forth, some sterile saline can be of great benefit to flush out wounds. So a little bit of sterile saline solution can work very nicely. For those people living in areas where there are ticks, and in particular the paralysis tick, there are special tick tweezers that you can use to extract ticks. I think that is good for the folk in those areas that have that concern. I think can be of benefit. So those would be a couple of the smaller basic items that I think can be of benefit. The products like your stingos and those sorts of things, I suppose it depends where they get stung. It's really something that has to be applied to the skin, and obviously with fur sometimes can affect or probably reduce the effectiveness of it, but it'd certainly be no harm in applying if there's an obvious sting or reaction that the patient does have.
So are you saying that stingos are safe to, or is there a different one? Like, just... Because you know how dogs like to lick.
Yes.
Like I would never want to pick.
Look, it really depends as to why the dog's licking, and there's obviously a whole variety of different reasons as to
sure,
why.
Sure, sure, but if you genuinely think the dog had been stung by something, is stingo, is what I'm asking, is stingo itself a safe product? Or is it
look, it'll help relieve a little bit of irritation that the skin may be feeling at the time and prevent, I suppose, the dog from traumatising the skin further. So, yes, there would certainly be no harm in applying that, and if it provides a little bit of itch relief or a little bit of comfort or soothing for the pet, by all means, there'd be no harm in applying that. And if they were to lick a little bit of that, is there any concern in that regard? And I'd say no, there would certainly be no harm or issues in that regard.
Well, thank you very much, Oren. May I just ask in relation to that, because of the time of year that all of Australia is heading towards with the hotter months, both with hot pavements, footpaths, roads and things like that, as well as with, I suppose, the thought of fire in various parts of Australia, which has already sadly started in Queensland. Is the threat with an animal more the actual flame in the fire, or is there something that can be done as a like a preparatory thing as soon as any smoke is detected or something like that if smoke is smelt?
Yeah, look, it's I suppose the fire affects both our pets and ourselves equally significantly, not only from the smoke, the effect of smoke that would have, so much like in how they obviously tell people to really keep low to the ground, to cover yourself in wet towels and so forth. The same would really apply to your pet there as well. When there's obviously concern of potential burns, much like obviously what we can be presented with, and that may be thermal burns as we're talking about now, but I suppose chemical, certainly and electrical as well. Obviously, they can create a lot of trauma to the skin and certainly a lot of pain and discomfort. So with generally most burns, it's always very important to remove yourself and your pet away from the situation as best as possible. And if there's an obvious burn to the skin and so forth, flushing under running water, that's such an important thing to try and obviously alleviate that severe trauma that the skin would be going through. So running water for at least 5 minutes is certainly a key thing. Be also mindful again of pain and distress that the patient or animal would be in. So again, just be mindful that you're being as relaxed and gentle and calming as possible. A lot of situations where animals are in severe forms of distress and discomfort will often result in shock as well. And sometimes wrapping a towel around or blanket certainly can provide some support, but it can also provide for warmth, which a lot of animals will become cold or hypothermic when they go into shock. So that's where towels are very, very important there. I was also going to mention another thing that we do see from time to time is heat stress or heat stroke. And that again, is a very, very serious condition. So unfortunately, there's always stories of parents leaving kids in cars, and likewise, we hear of pets being left in cars, and we all realize the impact of a harsh car having on an animal and a child. So that can be quite serious, and again, it's very important that if that is presented with, remove them from the situation, try and cool them down with wet blankets, wet towels, and then obviously immediate transfer to the local veterinary clinic. Again, it's a very, very important thing to do there.
Thank you. And when you were saying run a potential burn or a burnt area under running water, is there any difference in effect between cold water or just normal tap temperature water?
Well, I would say, John, to probably the ease of accessibility, running tap water would certainly be fine. As long as we've got water running over the area, obviously not hot water, but just normal cold tap water that we have running through the tap, that would certainly be fine.
Yeah.
Different, obviously, if we have a patient that is that has heat stroke, then we obviously want to try and have cold water as possible, or sometimes wrapping ice packs around them to assist with the reduction in the temperature. But for burns and so forth, running cold water is certainly more than adequate there.
Thank you. Now, if I can ask if there's somebody else that could introduce themselves with a question.
It's Rowena in Queensland.
Thank you. Hi, Rowena.
There's been a lot of publicity in the media lately about baiting of dogs, especially in the free-run dog areas.
I'm just wondering if you could talk about what would be the signs and symptoms, and what would be the appropriate first aid before you get the dog to the vet.
Yeah, unfortunately, baiting is you know, that's such a controversial topic there, isn't it? And unfortunately, it's the consequences of innocent animals that have access to it, and the repercussions thereof. There's obviously different sorts of baits that are used, and I think it probably will vary from territory to territory as to the type of baits that are used. Obviously, some have severe gastrointestinal side effects where there'd be sort of overt signs of profuse vomitings, diarrheas. Some toxins will affect them neurologically, so where we'll see seizures developing, loss of consciousness, or obviously certain toxins such as your rat baits, where obviously there's bleeding tendencies. So, yeah, unfortunately, all of those toxins can be significantly concerning and obviously can have rather dramatic consequences. Is there anything that can be done to really initiate vomiting? Most of the medications would be veterinary associated. One can use the washing crystals. I know that washing crystals can still be found in certain supermarkets. They are clear coloured, differently sized, almost looks like little ice blocks. So washing crystals or soda lime, that if one could dose a couple of those clear pellets down the throat, that will often initiate a vomiting response. So we certainly know that's one medication or a product that can be used. Otherwise, we have various other medications that we can administer to pets when they come into the clinic. But, yeah, it's really key is to get the animal in as quickly as you can, and hopefully supportive care can be done at the veterinary clinic to try and get the animal to recover, whichever means possible, whether they need to have an anaesthetic and a stomach flush and a gastric lavage done. Or whether they in some form of convulsions where they're going to need anti-epileptic medications, anaesthesia and so forth. So really it depends on the situation. But, yeah, most ingested toxins really need immediate veterinary care there.
Thank you for that, Rowena and Zoran. Now, anybody else that has a question for Zoran? Oh, well, I suppose it's a time when heading into the hotter weather that you'd need to be considering increasing the volume of water that the dog should be taking in each day too, Zoran. Would that be right?
Absolutely. Look, it's I think as long as they always have water available to them, and it depends on the level of activity that the pets are doing, depending on obviously the surrounding temperatures, how much panting they're doing as to how much fluid they're going to be expiring. So, yeah, it's always very important making sure that water is always freely available to them. And obviously cooler water, I think, is always a nicer thing for them to be drinking as opposed to hot water. So I suppose being mindful of where the water is being left out during the day, that obviously it's not in the heat of the sun. So making sure it's, again, reasonably protected by shade and so forth, that, you know, keeping the temperature of water cooler, I think, is an important thing there. Yeah.
And obviously, the number of times it's changed so it doesn't sort of become stale or stagnant and that sort of thing would also be more appealing to the, well, I know it would be to me, but obviously to the animal as well, I'd imagine.
Correct. Absolutely. It's I think a daily change when obviously you're feeding. I think changing the water bowl, I think, is a good thing. And we certainly know that sometimes they'll drop their toys or tennis balls or whatever else, other things that keep them preoccupied. So I suppose freshening up the water is not a bad thing to have done.
Okay. Well, just want to check with if there's anybody that has any questions still. I don't want to miss anybody out. And
it's Francois from Melbourne.
Yes,
I like the South African accent, by the way. My dog is one of those who every year, almost every year in summer, gets this ear infection. It's not bad, but he always needs to get ear drops. Now, some of these ear drops are quite expensive. Are you aware of any way to, in an accessible way, only put the three or whatever drops in it? I would either too much in, or maybe I think it's in the ear and it's not quite. So maybe any tips that we could use to make sure that we get the right quantity of ear
absolutely
into the ear.
Okay. Yeah, I was obviously going to compliment you on your impressive accent there as well. Look, with ears, yeah, they can be a real frustration. And you do find that certain dogs present with ear infections maybe certain times of the year, and that may be through various causes. So we'll find that certain dogs that love to swim, getting water into the ear certainly creates a lovely humid environment for certain pathogens to sort of overgrow in those ears, and that can lead to certain ear infections. Certain times of the year, if dogs are getting walked through certain fields where there's grass seeds and so forth, obviously grass seeds can move into different locations, and ears are one of the places that we see grass seeds going into, so that can be a real concern. But probably one of the main things that we'll see is allergies. You find that certain dogs suffer from various forms of allergies, and because the ears are really an extension of the skin, if the skin gets irritated, you'll very often find that the ears can become irritated as well. So that's why you'll find that certain dogs, certain times of the year, will get ear infections, and it's important to try and, one, identify what's the cause to the ear infection at the time. So hopefully the vet that's been doing your checkups and examinations on your guard dog would be taking a good ear slide and having a good look under the microscope. So there's different types of ear infections, and depending on the type of infection, we'll use different sorts of medications to get that under control. Now, with my clients, I always like to show them how much to administer into the ear. I actually use a syringe where I get the client to draw up a certain quantity with the syringe, and you can see exactly how much you're putting, because unfortunately a lot of, in times gone by, we'd sort of say, well, just give the bottle a squeeze for 1 or 2 seconds and, you know, you hope you get enough drops. But that's probably why we never get quite enough or adequate treatment of those cases. So as long as one is knowing that you've, one, applying the correct volume of ointment into the ears, and obviously with the right frequency, so most of the ear drops will be twice daily, and making sure that we then have a follow-up examination to make sure that we've got that infection nicely under control. And that's where, you know, some people will think, yeah, the ear infection is cleared, but a couple of weeks or a couple of months down the line, we're back to square one again, and it's possibly be because the ear was never thoroughly treated or had the infection completely cleared at the time.
Sorry, it's Nicole. Can I just make a quick suggestion?
Yes.
So when I had to give my dog medication through, as you say, a syringe, what my vet did, and I don't know if this would be helpful for anyone else, is, you know, as you draw the plunger up, the vet actually cut a little notch out of the side of the plunger so that then I could then draw and feel the notch as it came up out of the barrel of the syringe, because when you can't see, it's no good. You can't just draw medication into a syringe because you don't know where the plunger is.
Absolutely, and look, I think that's a fantastic suggestion. I know for certain clientele, I'd put a little wrap around the syringe to see where that, obviously, you draw the syringe to, or just. But I think putting a notch in the plunger so you know you can feel exactly to what point you need to draw the plunge out, I think that's a great idea, and certainly something that you can certainly raise with the vet or the nurse that gives you the medication, just to say, look, would you mind just making a little notch on that I know exactly how much I need to draw out of that particular preparation. So I think that's a fantastic idea, absolutely, and something hopefully everyone can take heed of there.
And it is on time.
Zoran, it's Annette here. I've just got a question about blocked anal glands. I've got a dog who scratches her bum along the ground. I do get them cleared out by the vet fairly regularly, but I'm just wondering, maybe diet-wise, is there anything that I can do, or do you have any other suggestions?
Yes, unfortunately, it's not a great social exercise when you have a dog out and they're rubbing their bum on the ground like that. So it's a bit of a spectacle, isn't it? But look, there's a variety of reasons as to why a dog will be exhibiting that behavior. And certainly impacted anal glands is by far the number one reason for dogs. And the reason why they have the anal glands is that it's really a scent marking function that dogs have. So when they pass a bowel movement, they have two little anal glands just inside the anal muscle area, and when they when they contract, those glands should naturally empty and release their content. And that acts as a really as a scent marker. So when dogs sniff one another's back end, that's really what they're identifying, is that the odor that is produced by the anal gland. So some dogs do need to have them expressed from time to time, and majority of dogs thankfully don't need to have that done, as most vets would be very happy not having to do that on a regular basis with every patient that comes in. But how can we aim to improve that? Certainly making sure that we're adding good fiber into their diet, because we'll find that fiber increases the content of the fecal material. So that means they need to squeeze a bit harder, and hopefully that helps them to naturally evacuate those glands a bit better. So that can certainly be of some benefit. So products like psyllium husks that you and I can take, and that's something we can get from probably any health food shop or pharmacy. You can add probably a level teaspoon of psyllium onto the food every day, and that can be of some benefit to patients that are having anal gland issues in that regard. Some people that like all bran flakes and those sorts of things, there's probably no harm in adding some of that. So any good source of fiber, I think, can be of some benefit. Now, other reasons as to why dogs will do that scooting behavior, it's not only anal glands, but some dogs, if there's certain intestinal worms, it's always very important, and I'm sure all of you guys would be very strict on your management of fleas and worms, etc. Yeah. So again, making sure they're up to date, that's one of the common concerns. Flea allergies, so some dogs that have flea allergies will present with that problem, but again, I'm sure most of you would be making sure that your pets are well protected against fleas. Certain infections in the skin can certainly present as well, so they can get irritations around allergies, can certainly cause it. And I do find in certain, particularly with females, because of their genital area, we sometimes can get infections and irritations around the genital area of females, and that too can sometimes cause interrupts. So I have some clients that have said, look, you know, the anal glands have been squeezed, but the dog's still doing that, but it's got a sort of a rampant infections around the genital, and that'll certainly cause them to be doing that activity as well. So not always anal glands. There could be other causes behind dogs doing that activity.
Okay, thank you.
That's a pleasure.
I have a question. It's Ilonka from Aubrey. The snake season is here again, and we walk the dog along the Murray River, and we have a lot of brown snakes. And there is the risk always that Zoe might be bitten. First aid for snake bite, is it just bandaging? Or what? Because we are usually quite far away from a vet.
Yes. Look, that, you know, snakes, and unfortunately Australia's got so many of these incredibly poisonous snakes that, you know, unfortunately, if you do get bitten by a snake, it's really the time is of the essence there. Much as in with humans, we want to try and reduce stress, because obviously with stress, you have an increased heart rate, you have increased blood supply. So trying to reduce as much stress and activity is such a key thing.
Mm-hmm.
Providing support to the area, so a bandage, a fairly tight wrap around the area, they say is obviously meant to reduce some of the toxin being liberated to the rest of the body. So those would really be the key things there at the time, is keep calm, keep your patient calm, wrap that area that has been bitten, and obviously try and get to a emergency center as quickly as you can, and potentially try and identify what snake it may have been, because there obviously can be specific antivenins depending on which snake has bitten. I know they have multivalent strains available, but I think it probably, if one can identify whether it was a brown snake or tiger snake, I think the treatment is probably a little bit more centered for that. But snakes, that's a real tough one. That and unfortunately, I think a lot of animals do succumb to those. Unfortunately.
And it would be important not to get not to put yourself in danger by trying to identify the snake running after it. And
absolutely, look, it's I suppose just being sensible. If it was, if you could see it at the time when it was bitten, fantastic. Or you know, obviously, will help with hopefully the treatment thereof. But yeah, never put yourself into a situation where you're going to be compromising yourself.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure then.
Somebody else that would like to ask Karen.
Yeah, it's Karen from Perth again. Licking, Zoran. My dog has always licked her paws, front paws, and also around her genital area and inner thighs. She hasn't got any hot spots because we checked that with the dog wash man. She's on specialised dog food. She's on antihistamine tablets, and she has specialised dog washing products. Is there anything else I can do because she still licks?
Yes, unfortunately, do you find that it's a seasonal thing or is it a yearly thing where she's licking?
I think it's all year round, but it may be seasonal as well.
Yes, so more than likely would be allergy related. Some dogs, it may be a psychological thing where licking a certain area is a sort of a pacifying thing for them. But that would probably just be one spot on the leg somewhere if you would. But if, let's say, all the feet are being licked, the groin, et cetera, then one would think that there's some form of contact allergy or some form of contact irritation that your little one is being exposed to. And it's the irritation from that contact to the allergen that obviously causes them to lick. The more they lick, the more they aggravate the skin. So then you have this vicious snowball effect that takes place. And the more you lick, the more prone you are to secondary infections in the skin. And then, obviously, an infected skin makes them lick in even further. So, it can become a real frustrating concern. Obviously, what you've been doing so far, I think, can certainly help in some regards. So, obviously, removing any potential pathogens off the skin. So, I do get some of my clientele, if they have to walk through certain areas or through certain grassy fields or if they've got certain grasses and plants at home, I tell them what they can do is add a little bit of Epsom salts to water and just give the feet a little bit of a bathe, the groin and chest area. So those contact areas where those pollens, et cetera, would be adhering and hopefully then minimizing the desire for the dog to lick at those areas.
Oh, good. Okay, I'll try that.
So you can certainly give that a try. Obviously, there are certain medications. Antihistamines are really a bit of a hit and miss. Certain antihistamines, there's a whole spectrum of human antihistamines which we can use in pets.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, a lot of those don't work as effectively as what we like. There are other medications that are available for the anti-itch effect. Cortisone has always been sort of a cornerstone therapy, but unfortunately there are some side effects with cortisone, so we try not to use that for any extended period of time. But there are some really revolutionary new drugs on the market now which certainly suppress and stop the itch quite significantly in our pets, but unfortunately they are quite expensive. That's unfortunately the downside, but they do work wonderfully, and I have a lot of patients that are on it, and the owners are very, very happy that their dogs aren't nearly as itchy and irritated by their skin as they used to be there. You'll often find that dogs, again, with allergies, you'll find that they're probably not only allergic to one thing, it may be a multiple of things that they could be allergic to. So it's a good thing that you're managing the diet, because we know that a lot of dogs will suffer from allergies from foods, and that could be certain protein types. There might be certain glutens, wheats, etc. So I think in those regards, always being selective in the type of food that you're feeding, to make sure that we are eliminating as any potential food allergens that can be causing it. And it's great to see there's a lot of grain-free diets coming onto the markets these days, because I think there's a lot of allergic skins, allergic bowels, etc., that are hopefully being better managed by us feeding better foods these days to our pets.
Soren,
it's Nicole again. Can I just ask, so my first dog retired prematurely with arthritis.
Yes.
So my current working dog, he's okay at the moment. I give him a fish oil each day. But I've heard, you know, like about rose hip vitamin. I've heard about Sasha's blend. You know, you hear about all these other things that in theory you could maybe give the dog to support the dog, maybe before symptoms present. What is your views on them? Are there anyone that you think are particular better? Because some of them are pretty expensive too. And I'm just sort of thinking, should I be giving him some? He's 5, my current working boy.
Yes.
What is your views on preventative stuff?
Well,
arthritis in Labradors.
Yeah. Look, any large breed dog has the potential to develop arthritic change. I think that's just a factor of age and the impact of movement, et cetera, on joint and joint function. So certainly large breed dogs are more predisposed, and obviously Labradors are amongst the larger breed dogs. I'd certainly like to believe that through the very selective breeding process that guide dogs and seeing eye dogs have instituted over the years to make sure that they've eliminated a lot of joint conditions, which obviously can affect some of the breeding dogs, such as your hip dysplasias and elbow dysplasias, and those are notoriously aggressive conditions that are, that affect joints and lead to sort of fairly advanced osteoarthritic change. So I'd be hoping that the majority of the dogs that you will have would certainly be at lower risk of developing those severe conditions. But does one be proactive in putting them to medications, and when's the right time to put them onto what I call the nutraceuticals, as you mentioned? So products like your fish oil, so anything that contains omega-3 and omega-6 oils, they say has some natural anti-inflammatory properties for joints. It's obviously good for their skin. So I think using products like that, they can be fairly cheap, and that's something that you and I can take, and that's certainly something we can give to our pets as well. So there'd certainly be no harm in giving them products like that. Glucosamines and chondroitin sulfates, they say that there are some good joint-related product or effects that those medications will have. Correct, rosehip, turmeric, there's obviously quite a few different things. But I think when you do go to your local vet, and hopefully when they have the regular examinations, the vets would be doing a thorough examination, feeling the joints, watching how they're moving, and hopefully they'll be able to assess to what degree there's any obvious discomfort or hesitation on movement from the pet, and they would then be saying, well, look, maybe we should be starting to incorporate certain medications into our pet's diet to look after their joints as best possible. So, yeah, I think it's when do you start it? I'd say as they start getting into their senior years, I think that's probably a very good thing to start. So probably anything above 8 years of age, I think using some of those products can only be of some benefit to their joints. Starting it earlier, is it going to prevent arthritis from developing? Probably not. But will it help the animal cope better once it is starting to get some change? Then I'd say probably yes.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you for that, Zoran. And may I just ask, with the fish oil tablets, is there any negative side effect? I did hear some sort of suggestions that having fish oil, a dog might experience some other side effects that which may be unpleasant. Are you aware of anything in that regard?
John, I'd say probably would really just depend on the concentration of fish oil that you're giving. So I think when you have these triple strength and higher strength products, or if you're giving multiple capsules, I think it certainly in some patients can obviously lead to gastrointestinal upsets. So I suppose we can get loose bowels. They do say that some patients, if they have any concern with their pancreas, high doses of fish oils can affect their pancreas and sometimes can lead to conditions called a pancreatitis, which can be quite a serious concern. So I think one just has to be careful that we're not giving them too much of those sorts of products there.
Thank you very much. All right. Well, look, it's going to be, we'll take some more questions, but obviously need to let Zoran go in a short period of time. So just to encourage you that if you have anything you'd like to ask, we'd like to include as many folks as possible in this teleconference, and we'll close it down probably in about 10 minutes or so. Is there anybody else that would like to ask a question in the meantime?
Joyce from Toowoomba. Yes, my veterinary surgeon told me that all of the tablets could be just given in one tablet, and yet the veterinary surgeon at Guide Dogs Queensland told me that it doesn't cover tapeworm, and we have to go back to HeartGuard, NexGuard and ParaGuard. So what's your opinion on that one, Zoran? Is it possible to just have that one tablet that everyone says is necessary, or NexGuard, or should we have the three tablets?
Sorry, which product were you using there? Sorry, your phone is just a very bad one.
The vet told me that NexGuard would cover everything.
Look, I'd feel pretty comfortable and confident that NexGuard is really going to cover for most things. Yes, certain products might not cover for tapeworm as effectively. Now, the really reason why they'll pick up tapeworm is if they pick up fleas. Fleas obviously will carry those larval stages for tapeworm. So I think if we're being strict on our flea control, the likelihood of them picking up tapeworm would be quite negligible. So those sorts of products, I think, do work very effectively for most of the intestinal worms that are available, but one can use a tapeworm from time to time, whether it's done maybe once or twice a year, just to be on the safe side that we're covering everything completely, then I think that can be done. But most of those comprehensive products do a pretty good job.
Right, thanks. That answers the question.
Okay.
Thank you. Anybody else that would like to ask Zoran a question before we wrap up for this evening? I suppose that's something we have to do, be aware regularly to do the HeartGuard or the fentanyl or the various worming tablets that make sure that it's done on a timely basis, Zoran, so that you know, things don't get forgotten or put off and then put out of mind, I suppose, and then become a problem.
Absolutely, John. Look, it's again, it's so important that we are keeping our pets in really in prime health and condition, and preventing those diseases is such a key thing. So making sure that we're covering for intestinal worms, which we know obviously can cause various forms of gastrointestinal health issues. Likewise with fleas, you know, fleas can certainly create a lot of unhappiness with patients, particularly with allergies. So using a good prevention against fleas is such an essential thing, and certainly heartworm. Heartworm's obviously more prevalent in certain areas than in others, and again, that is an incredibly debilitating disease condition. So, you know, being proactive and making sure preventing against those forms of conditions, it's, you know, essential for your pet and peace of mind, knowing that they are protected and that we're covering all the essentials there.
Just a quick one, Zoran. Sorry, it's Nicole again. So my dog, he absolutely refuses to eat NexGard or NexGard Spectra. He won't even chew. But if I chop the tablet up and pop it into the food, he'll eat it then. Is that okay?
Yes.
Because he has
absolutely fine. Look, it's as long as the right size medication is administered for his body size, absolutely.
Yeah.
Whether you crumble it or whether you ingest it whole, that certainly would be fine. So it's mode of action and its process of development, etc., will be done equally effectively as long as the total quantity has been given correctly there. So definitely no concern. And I know that some dogs can be a real menace to administer medications. So if you find that you have to disguise it in a bit of food to get them to take it, by all means, make it easier for yourselves, and as opposed to having to struggle and lose a finger in the process of trying to get the tablet down the back of their throat. So whatever's easier for you, as long as the total medication is administered, it will work as effectively, yes.
Great, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Anne here, may I ask a question?
No, certainly, yes.
I've got a black lab, and when I've groomed her, I'm told she gets a bit of dandruff, or it appears. Is there... It's not a first aid question, but is there a simple way to treat the dandruff? I've tried putting canola oil on her food.
Yes.
That didn't seem to do anything.
Again, I suppose there'll be different reasons as to why dogs will get a little bit of dryness in the coat. Now, is she showing any form of itching and scratching? So she's not troubled by her skin at the moment?
Actually, she scratches occasionally, but not very often.
Nothing excessive. Okay. Well, that, again, obviously that'll eliminate a few skin conditions, and a lot of those will be causing the dog's itch and scratch. So something called seborrhea sicca. So it's basically just a dry skin that'll develop in some dogs. Making sure that we're feeding a good quality diet certainly can be of great benefit to the general health and well-being of the coat. So I'm not sure what you're feeding at the moment.
Local guide dogs recommend Advance dry dog food, and I've been feeding her that.
Okay. So sometimes we can try maybe a different brand of food or a different quality of food and see if that can make a difference. Otherwise, again, we can supplement some omega oils into the diet. The omega-3 and omega-6 oils certainly can help with the texture and coat condition, and can take a little bit of the dryness out of the skin.
Yep.
How frequently are you bathing your dog?
I've only had her a bit over 3 months, so I've only bathed her once.
Okay, all right. So I know some owners might bath their dogs a little bit too frequently, and much like in humans, if you bath, you know, if you obviously using certain types of shampoos and so forth, that can be quite astringent on the skin and can really dry the skin out. So I like to use your oatmeal shampoos and conditioners. They're very gentle on the skin, and they sometimes can help nicely. So it might be a combination of things with diet, some added omega oils, and using a conditioned shampoo can certainly help and hopefully improve the condition of the coat.
Yes. Okay. Thanks for that.
And I suppose we should ask, Soren, what is a good period of time to leave the dog between bathing?
Well, look, I suppose it's a relative thing there. I have some clientele who say, well, the dog sleeps in the bed, so they have to bath their dog every week. Whereas some say, look, they might do it every 2 months or every 3 months. So is there an obvious frequency? It really depends, I suppose, on what the dog's activity is, what areas they're going through, how dirty they're getting, depending on where they sleep, et cetera. So once a month, would that be too much? Would it be not enough? I'd say that probably would be fine. How often do my own dogs, John? I probably do them once every 6 weeks. But, and you know, because they don't smell, and so that doesn't trouble me at all. So, you know, some dogs love being bathed, some don't, and I suppose it depends on the enjoyment factor that they get out of being bathed. So, but I think generally not more than once every 2 weeks, unless they have a medical condition which warrants them to be bathed more frequently with a medicated shampoo. You know, if you're doing it once every 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, I don't think there'd be an obvious indication as to, it really depends on whether you find the dog being offensive with certain smells, etc., and you feel the need to be bathing them. For me, I often find a good brush on a regular basis that can certainly help as well, and sort of strips a lot of the undercoat, makes them feel a little bit nicer as well. So I think a good regular brushing is probably just as important as a regular bath.
So, yeah, so a daily grooming, and then if you were doing it every 4 to 6 weeks, if that was too frequent, you'd get some sort of idea through the skin condition. Would that be right?
Yeah, that's it. You'd get sort of a reasonable idea. Absolutely, yeah.
Well, thank you. Now, because we're going to wrap up shortly, I'd just like to open it to the floor to see if there's anybody that hasn't had a chance or who has a question that they'd like to ask, and I'd like to thank Soren so much for taking the time to be with us and field so many different types of inquiries. Anybody else that would like to ask something?
Anne here. May I ask another question, please?
Sure. What was your name?
Anne from Hobart.
Yes, Anne.
How long should a dog's toenails get before you should get them clipped?
It would really depend on the type of nail that we're talking. Fortunately, most of large breed dogs, the frequency with which they need to have their nails trimmed really gets sort of few and far between. You find that the heavier dogs tend to be more abrasive on their nails, and the need to trim them is really few. The number of times that I compare large dogs with small dogs, I certainly do small dog nails far more frequently than I would need to do large dog nails. The ones that may need to be regularly trimmed could be the dew claws. We'll find that sometimes the dew claws might not be making enough contact, which causes them to overgrow, and hence the need to have them trimmed. Most of the concern really is with dogs that have really curved nails, but fortunately most of our large breed dogs, they don't have that obvious concern. But long nails, yes, they can sometimes get them hooked and caught on things, and we do see dogs with pulled nails from time to time. Where obviously they need to have that bandaged up when they pull a nail, and obviously can be quite painful for them. But again, your local vet should be able to advise you, because you always have to be careful how short you cut the nails as well, because they certainly have a pretty good blood supply, and clearly they have a nerve supply to it as well. So if you cut them too short, one, they'll bleed, and they can be pretty sore for them as well. So one always has to be a little bit careful as to when you are trimming the nails, how short you need to trim them back.
So when I'm checking the nails, if I can feel that the nails are curving a lot, then I should get some advice perhaps.
if there's a fair bit of length or some curl to the nails, then yes, that's something that may need to be addressed. But I often certainly mention to a lot of my clients is, you know, if you're walking them, make sure you're walking them mostly on hard surfaces, so cemented ground, etc. And again, it's that natural wear on the nails when they're walking on that certainly minimizes the need to have them regularly trimmed, because that keeps them short, reasonably short that way there.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Anne. Anybody else that would like to ask before we wrap up for this evening in this teleconference? No? All right. Well, it's for me to say thank you very much indeed to Dr. Warren Milosevic for taking the time to be with us at Dog Guide Handlers Australia tonight for this first teleconference. And thank you also to all of the members and interested folks that have joined with us. I hope that you found the teleconference to be of value and to be of interest. I thank you, Zoran, and express the appreciation on behalf of the committee for taking the time to be with us tonight.
It's been a pleasure, and thanks very much for having me, and thanks for the questions, and hopefully there's a little bit of information that you guys have can take home, and if there's hopefully future teleconferences, I'll be more than happy to answer more questions again in the future. I know that on the spot we sometimes might forget certain questions, but please keep them in thought for if there's a future conference that we do have, and great to chat to everyone.
Thank you indeed.
Thank you, Zoran.
Thank you.
I was also going to say, if you do happen to, and I might be overextending myself here, but if you think of any questions, it could well be that you can send an email through to DGHA@DGHA, and then we could either bring them to the attention of Zoran and get some suggestions or advice for you. But otherwise, to also let you know that in a couple of months we have another interesting teleconference, or what I hope will be interesting, and that will be examining the ins and outs and the requirements of the National Disability Insurance Scheme in terms of how it relates to assistance animals of all kinds, and what planners and delegates of the NDIA and the government have to keep in mind, and also what the charter is to provide assistance for people who are blind, vision impaired, and who have assistance animals. So that's in a couple of months in November, the last Wednesday in November, so hopefully we can look forward to welcoming you back at that time. From my point of view, thank you for taking the time to be with us there this evening. And I believe that the committee can hold on after this. I think that's what happens. And but to welcome and to say goodnight to all the other members. And again, thank you for joining us.
This has been a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation. If you would like further information on Dog Guide Handlers Australia, or like to listen to further audio, please go to our website, www.dgha.org.au. Thank you. Do you always have to have the last word?